Well, it's wonderful to see everybody here today. If we have any visitors that are with us this morning, then I want to personally invite you to have your Bibles out, to consider some things from the Word of God, to have your hearts open as well. If there are things that you observe around you this morning that you have questions about, please let any one of us know. We'd love to sit down and have a Bible study with you and present what the gospel is. That could serve as a good introduction to my lesson this evening, actually. And I'd like to encourage you to come back tonight for a lesson on what is the gospel. Is the gospel just the story of Jesus Christ, or is there more to it than that? So please come back tonight for that lesson. But this morning, I want to introduce our lesson by giving you some statistics. Because, right, isn't that public speaking 101? Don't start a sermon by using a bunch of statistics. The Pew Research Center conducted a study on marriage back in 2010. They found that 39% of Americans stated that marriage was becoming obsolete. 39% of Americans believed marriage was becoming obsolete, compared to 28% of Americans only about 30 years earlier. Furthermore, 29% of children now live with a parent or parents who are not married, which is a fivefold increase from 1960. 15% of children have parents who are divorced or separated. And of course, all of this sounds very discouraging, doesn't it? We were wondering, is marriage becoming obsolete? You see that as a theme, in fact, in a lot of pop culture. Watch just about any sitcom and you'll see alternative lifestyles being promoted in that sitcom, our music, our literature, our movies. What is marriage anymore, after all? Marriage is an old institution. It's old-fashioned. It's outdated. We don't need it anymore, right? We have open relationships now. We have relationships that are not based on marriage, that are not necessarily based on the Bible's definition of love, but on many other definitions of love. So, is marriage becoming obsolete? Have we evolved socially, physically, or otherwise beyond the need for marriage in our culture? While all of this sounds very discouraging, there was a glimmer of hope in the Pew Research statistics. Another statistic said that 67% of Americans still feel upbeat about the future of marriage. Isn't that interesting how 39% of Americans believe it's becoming obsolete, yet 67% of Americans still feel upbeat about its future? Now, I don't know what the crossover is on that. I don't know how many people believe it's obsolete but still feel upbeat about it. I'm sure there is some crossover, which to me says something about our society's approach to old-fashioned things. It's easy and convenient for us to dismiss a lot of things as being old-fashioned or outdated, and yet why is it that we still keep old cars? Why do we restore old houses? Why do we keep shoeboxes full of keepsakes from our childhood? Why is it that when somebody leaves behind a grandfather clock or a pocket watch or some other kind of family relic, why do we cherish those things so much? Why do we have a historic register of old buildings in this country? Maybe it's because even though we think some things are outdated and old-fashioned or even obsolete, we still cherish them because of the connection to the past. So, sure, maybe there are people who think marriage is outdated, but just because something is outdated doesn't mean it's not valuable. The Pew Research Institute conducted another survey in 2013, a few years after that, which found that 61% of people who had never been married before still wanted to get married. For something that's so old-fashioned and obsolete and out of date, 61% of people who still want to get married, that's an awful lot of people excited about marriage. And I think that if you kind of go to just about any bridal convention, you will realize that there is no shortage of people out there who want to have great big weddings. Of course, giant weddings is not really an indication that people want to get married as God defines it, but I still think that marriage is safe. Marriage is going to stick around. Marriage will always be here. Marriage is not going anywhere. And as obsolete as people might think that it is, marriage is the most time-tested human relationship of them all. Things that have lasted for thousands of years do not become obsolete. So, is it obsolete? Perhaps the question is not whether marriage itself is becoming obsolete, but what kinds of marriages are prone to failure. Saying that marriage is failing is too broad a judgment. To me, saying that marriage is becoming obsolete or that it's failing is akin to saying that the automotive industry is failing because one company goes bankrupt, while other companies might be thriving. Yeah, there's a lot of failed marriages out there. Nobody's denying that. Nobody's denying that 50% of marriages end in divorce. Of course, understand that statistic can be a bit deceiving, and you need to be equipped with this knowledge. It's not saying that 50% of people get divorced. It's saying that 50% of marriages end in divorce. A lot of those divorces are second or third or fourth divorces. Understand that. 50% of people do not get divorced. Try to understand that about that statistic. But we're not denying, though, that there are a great many marriages that fail. We're not denying that at all. But there are a lot of marriages that do well in spite of it. In spite of what our culture says about it, in spite of the assessment that our culture tends to give when it comes to marriage, there are a lot of successful, happy marriages out there. And there are a lot of young people today, especially in the Christian community, who are laying a good groundwork, a good foundation for having a happy marriage when the time comes for them to get married as well. One writer put it really well in an article called "What the Pew Survey Really Says About Marriage Becoming Obsolete." He says, "Romantic love, as we came to know it, as expressed in our literature, our films, and other things, is a modern phenomenon born out of the expanded leisure class. Centuries ago, this was not an option, or more like a dalliance or indulgent. It was simply one thing that the nobility could partake of because only they had the time to indulge in it." I think that's an interesting notion. Why do people get married today? Most people get married today because they're lovey-dovey, because they're sexually attracted to another person, or maybe there's money involved. There's a lot of reasons why people get married that are not the real reasons to get married. You ever think about how in other cultures the divorce rate is not as high as ours? And yet, we're this very, very romantic culture. We've got all the romantic music and R&B ballads, and we've got movies about romance and chick flicks that make millions of dollars. We're a very romantic culture. We spend tens of thousands of dollars on weddings for marriages that are prone to failure. And yet, there are a lot of other cultures, not just in history, but even that exists today, where divorce is almost unheard of, and they do not have this crazy romantic notion about marriage. In India, for example, let me give you a few things, because, boy, you don't have enough statistics yet, do you? You want some more statistics? I only got 4 hours of sleep last night because of one member of our family. So the statistics are keeping me really excited right now. In India, around 75% of Indians, 82% of women, and 68% of men prefer arranged marriages. 75% of Indians prefer arranged marriages, according to a 2013 survey. Divorce is almost unheard of in India. It's estimated that the divorce rate in India is around 1%. And it is often viewed as quite scandalous as well. Most young Indians prefer arranged marriages because they trust their parents to make the right decision. They believe that marriage is a responsibility that should be reserved for their parents. They trust that who their parents select, or at least the number of options, the parents might provide 3 or 4 or 5 different options for that person to marry, and they trust that who their parents present them with will be quality individuals. Think about that. We have a society that is based on chick flicks and $50,000 weddings, but 50% of our marriages end in divorce. They have a society where the majority, the vast majority of people enter into marriage because of an arrangement made by their parents. And they have a 1% divorce rate. Now, I'm not discounting romance at all. I'm not discounting that. But again, the question becomes, is marriage itself obsolete? Or are Americans just bad at it? Marriage was not invented yesterday. It was not even invented 1,000 years ago, or 2,000 years ago, or 5,000 years ago. It is as old as humanity itself. In Mark chapter 10 and verse 6, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female, Jesus Christ said. As we've already read earlier in our worship service and in our Bible classes this morning in Genesis chapter 2, from the very beginning, God created them male and female. He created Adam. And God knew, and I'm sure Adam recognized it as well, that there was not a helpmeet suitable, a companion that was comparable to him on the face of the earth until Eve was taken from his side, created from his rib. He says, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, you are woman because you were taken from the side of man. And it is for this reason that man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, for the two become one flesh. Things that work well for thousands of years do not just become obsolete. There is certainly something to be said about time-tested institutions such as marriage. And it feels to me like nothing more than arrogance to say that we have a new or better way of defining or practicing humanity's most intimate and essential relationship. There are certain kinds of marriages that have never worked. And so don't be surprised when a lot of marriages fail. If those marriages were based on something that God had proscribed, then of course they're going to fail. Marriages that are based on money are going to fail. Marriages that are based on nothing but physical attraction are going to fail. Marriages that are based on nothing but convenience or political relationships, those marriages are going to fail as well. Marriages that are based on selfishness are going to fail. So yeah, marriage is not obsolete. We're just doing it wrong. So what I want to do with this part of the lesson is consider from the Bible three marriages that were destined to fail. Not because marriage is broken, but because they were doing it wrong. I say destined to fail. I should correct myself and say that no marriage is destined to fail if you can acknowledge what you're doing wrong and correct it. Let's consider in Esther chapter 1, the king Ahasuerus in Esther chapter 1 is throwing a great big party. And when I say a great big party, I mean the greatest party of all time. You cannot imagine what the gift bags must have looked like at a party like this. Everybody who came to this party, it says according to the text, was drinking from a golden cup. That's a party when every single guest is drinking from a golden cup. Essentially, what Ahasuerus was trying to do was he was trying to show off the wealth of his kingdom, the glory of his kingdom, his power, his authority, his greatness. And when it came near the end of this great feast, this great party of his, he wanted to show off what perhaps was the most beautiful treasure in his entire collection, which was his glorious and gorgeous queen. According to Esther chapter 1, though, Vashti, the queen, had no interest in being paraded around by her drunk husband to all of his rich friends. So, in what they interpreted to be quite a disrespectful tone, she says, no, she does not want to be paraded around. Let's consider this marriage, though. Like many rulers of his day, he wanted to show off his beautiful queen. According to the text in verse 11, it says that he wanted to display her beauty to the people and the princes, but she refused. Like many marriages today, this king was apparently only interested in marrying a person for her beauty. And you see that played out. When Vashti is sent away, he wants to marry somebody else. And how does he figure out who he's going to marry? By basically holding Miss Persia. He has all the most beautiful virgins from the land come and go through a step-by-step competition, which if you interpret the text a certain way, I think you could see that there was a lot going on in this competition that was rather immoral. He wanted to find somebody beautiful. He wanted the most beautiful person in all the land to stand by his side, or rather at his feet, however it is he wanted to place her. He wanted to marry someone for beauty. Unfortunately, we see a lot of superficial marriages today as well. You ever hear it when people say, oh, they'd have beautiful kids together? I know that might be true because, you know, our kids are just gorgeous. And certainly not because of my genes, that's for sure. But I often wonder about phrases like that. Boy, they'd have beautiful kids together. Like, was that all you see? I'm not accusing you of that, but I just wonder, is that all we see? Do we see two beautiful people? When you go to a wedding and people give the speeches afterward at the reception, what do they say? What a beautiful couple. The bride was so beautiful. The groom was so handsome. You're so beautiful. And when you see a couple who are mismatched, you know who I'm talking about, right? When you see a couple that are mismatched, you go, why did she ever marry him? Do you wonder sometimes if maybe our culture is focused on the wrong things when it comes to marriage? Beautiful people need to marry other beautiful people. Ugly people just need to stick together because, well, they can't do any better. Is that what we see of marriage, though? Is that what we see? We see so many superficial marriages. So I'm saying, don't be surprised when a marriage that is based on outward beauty fails. That is the kind of marriage that is prone to dysfunction. But what about this? Jacob and the two sisters, Rachel and Leah. We're all familiar with the story. We've studied Genesis enough times. We know that Jacob worked for 7 years so that he could marry Rachel. And because he forgot to flip that veil over before consummating the marriage, he wakes up the next morning and goes, what? You're not Rachel. You're Leah. He married her sister by accident. So he ends up marrying Rachel as well. He becomes a polygamist. How does that marriage work out? Well, at first he loves Rachel. The text clearly says that he loves Rachel dearly. That's Genesis 29 and verse 20. He loves her even more than he loves Leah, which is always good. You know, if you're going to become a polygamist, it's always best to show favoritism right from the very start, isn't it? But notice a couple things. Turn to Genesis 30 real quick. And I want to notice just a couple things here about this marriage. Notice some of the features of this marriage and how this marriage had gone from, at least between Jacob and Rachel, a loving relationship to something that was a whole lot worse than that. In Genesis chapter 30, up till this point, Leah is the only one who's been having kids. Rachel is barren. She can't have kids at this point. And what does that cause in the relationship? Well, there's tension between Rachel and Leah. There's tension between Rachel and Jacob. There's tension between Leah and Jacob. That's the problem with this whole relationship. It's completely dysfunctional from the very start. What does it say here in verse 1 of Genesis 30? Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister, and she said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. Really? If you don't have children, that's it. If you don't have kids, you'd rather be dead than to be married to Jacob and have no children. Sometimes marriages become nothing but function. They're just functional. Marriages are all about the kids. I stay married to that person because I have kids with them. Or marriages become less than that because we can't have kids, like with Rachel. I want to get out of this marriage. Find somebody else. Start over again with somebody else. This marriage had become purely a functional marriage. It was all about making babies. And it becomes ludicrous. If you keep reading in Genesis 30, this becomes a comedy of errors. It is comically ludicrous the way this all happens. Because Rachel can't have kids, she gives her handmaid to Jacob and says, here! Have sex with her, make babies with her, and they'll be my babies, technically speaking. And Leah will really get it this time. Well, Leah gets jealous about it, so she shoves her handmaid at Jacob and says, well, have some babies with my handmaid then. And they start having babies. And then finally, Rachel starts having babies. And they all get mad at each other. And it ends up here in verse 14. Look at this in verse 14. So in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went out and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also?" So Rachel said, "Therefore, he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come in with me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." So he lay with her that night. This is what their marriage had become. This is what their marriage had become. "Well, I'll tell you what, I'll go ahead and buy him for tomorrow night, but it's going to cost you some mandrakes. Well, I'll trade you Thursday for Tuesdays because I go to spinning class on Tuesday nights." Like, this is what their marriage had become. And is it any surprise then that Rachel is miserable and Leah is miserable and Jacob is miserable and the two handmaids, I assume, are probably pretty miserable in all this as well? And then, of course, there's Abigail and Nabal in 1 Samuel chapter 25. There was not a whole lot of love lost between these two people. Abigail is a wonderful human being, by the way. Abigail is described by the text as exceedingly beautiful and incredibly intelligent. She's a dynamo of a woman who, I would assume, because of political or business arrangements, is married to an absolutely worthless person. An absolutely worthless man. That's what Nabal even means. Nabal means failure or worthless or fool. I think we're familiar with the story, but for those who aren't, we'll kind of do the short version. Nabal was a man, a Calebite, who owned property and flocks. This was during the time when David was hiding in the wilderness, fleeing from King Saul. But David had surrounded himself with several hundred elite individuals who became sort of a fighting force, almost a Robin Hood and his merry men sort of a force that protected people. Well, through the course of things, they were on Nabal's land, and they actually protected Nabal's shepherds. His servants had said specifically to Abigail that David's men were a wall about us. They protected us from the dangers around us. And because David offered some protection to Nabal's servants, David assumed that he might get some provisions from Nabal's household, some food and other sorts of things on his journey. When Nabal hears about this, what does he think of David? He says, "Should I recognize this David fellow? Who is David that I should give him help?" He rejects David's request for provisions. David, rightfully so, is enraged at this and decides that he's going to go on the warpath. When Abigail, Nabal's wife, hears about David's anger, she goes out of her way to fill up a cart full of all the provisions and then some that David would need. Raisin cakes, bread, wine, everything that David would need. And she presents them to David in an incredibly intelligent and contrite manner. She saves her whole family's lives, her family and her servants. When Nabal finds out what his wife had done, going behind his back to do a good deed and save his life, he ends up falling over from a stroke and dies. Not a whole lot of love lost there, especially when your own wife, a woman who's described as exceedingly intelligent, a wise and righteous woman, someone who carried herself incredibly well in the eyes of God, when even your own wife goes around and says, "Well, Nabal is his name and Nabal is him." Nabal means fool or worthless. My husband is a worthless fool. It's his name and so he is. Not a lot of love lost between them. Unfortunately, things haven't changed a whole lot. A marriage of self-interest or where one spouse is acting foolishly or selfishly, that again is a marriage that is prone to dysfunction. They were probably not a happy married couple. Nabal was a horrible man. A horrible, horrible man who died a horrible death. And yet they were married. And I think that we need to give Abigail a ton of credit for sticking with that marriage. So what is real marriage then? We've looked at the fake marriages. We've looked at marriages that don't work. What is a marriage that's real? How do I know if I'm doing it right? because some are convinced that marriage is so obsolete that we could never know, we could never conceive, we could never even guess how to make a marriage work today. I think for some people, it's just a gamble. People get married and they say, well, you know, it's a 50-50. We might stay married, we might get divorced. It's a 50-50, it's just a gamble. Real marriages, according to the Bible, are where men give happiness to their wives. In Deuteronomy 24 and verse 5, there's actually a provision written in the law in Deuteronomy 24 that says that when a man gets married, he shall not be put into military service for a year. He shall not be given responsibilities, aside from, I think, typical responsibilities for a man, working and that sort of thing. But he shall not have responsibilities imposed on him, such as military service for the first year of his marriage. So that, according to the text, and I love this, so that he may give happiness to his wife. Real marriages involve men who want to make their wives happy. Living joyfully in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9. Live joyfully with the woman who you love all the days of your life, because this is a fleeting life. Your wife is your reward, who you are given. I love it. Enjoy life with your wife. Enjoy it. A real marriage is one where you enjoy it. And notice from the text in Ecclesiastes 9:9, it says, all the days of your fleeting life, not just the good days, not just the days where you have money in the bank, not just the days where you're able to pay your mortgage and things are going well and everybody has a job and the kids are healthy, not just those days, but all the days of your fleeting life. Enjoy life with the woman who you love. That's real marriage. Real marriage is the man being intoxicated with love. In Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 19, be intoxicated always with her love. And I love that. What a great idea to be intoxicated with your wife's love. I think there's just never too much love that a husband and wife can share between each other. Rejoicing, chapter 5 and verse 18. Rejoice in the wife of your youth, he says. Sacrifice in Ephesians 5 and verse 25. The marriage between the husband and the wife is likened to the marriage between Christ and his church. And how did Christ love his church? By dying for her. He loved her so much that he was willing to give his life for her. Do you love your spouse enough that you'd give your life? Here's a question, though, because it's not always about giving your life. You notice in all of our marriages, we're very infrequently asked to give our lives for our spouse. Like, it's not very often where there's some hypothetical scenario that comes up where I have to take a bullet for Rebecca. Haven't come up very often, at least. That's not what makes a marriage great, though. Giving your life for your spouse is one thing. Living your life every single day doing the little things. Now, that's something special. Which doesn't take away from Jesus' sacrifice at all, because Jesus does the daily little things as well. In loving us, teaching us, answering our prayers. Do you think Jesus just died on the cross and then said, well, that's it. I've done everything I'm going to do for humanity now. No. He gave his life for his bride, and then he was raised from the dead and lived every single day for her. Jesus' life, both in this world and in his eternal existence at the right hand of the Father, is expended and spent in our service. Do you do the same thing? There's a lot of people out there who'd probably take a bullet for their wife. But do you spend every day doing the little things along the way? That's what's asked of us. We're not asked to die for our wives. We're asked to live with them every single day in an understanding manner, according to 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. Nourishing and cherishing, Ephesians 5 and verse 29. An expert on your spouse. I love it. In 1 Peter 3, verse 7, when it talks about living with your wife in an understanding manner, what I take away from that is that you understand your wife better than anybody else. And you understand your wife better than you understand anybody else's wife as well. You know your wife. You are an expert in your spouse. You know what makes them tick. You know what makes them annoyed. You know what makes them angry. But you also know what makes them happy. And you live with your spouse in an understanding way because you understand her, because you understand him. Offering support, the very first marriage in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18, it is said that she was a helpmeet suitable for Adam, for the man. In your marriage, are you a suitable helpmeet? Do you offer support to your husband? Do you offer support to your wife? In Proverbs 31 and verse 12, it is said that the excellent wife does good all her days so that her husband and her children rise up and bless her. So that her husband, in those magnificent words, says, "Many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all." That's a real marriage. A real marriage is based on respect. Ephesians 5 and verse 33. A real marriage is based on teaching the value of love to the next generation. In Titus chapter 2, notice what it says here. And I love the way that it's put here, speaking of the responsibility that women have to the girls in the next generation. In Titus chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, "Older women likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good, that they may encourage the young women to love their husbands and to love their children." Real marriages serve as examples to the younger generation. So the kids at church, the kids in your family, the kids who observe you will see that's what marriage is supposed to be like. Rather than always seeing the bad examples on The Simpsons and Family Guy and every other sitcom out there, our children need to be exposed to good marriages. They are one flesh, and as they are one flesh, so they care for one another as one cares for his own body. So, some practical tips then. One writer summed up all these things when he said, "When I look at the above description of marriage, how could such a beautiful institution become obsolete? Especially considering the most basic need in every person is to be genuinely loved. Secondly, how could a marriage that practices the above principles ever fail? I wonder that. How could this marriage possibly fail? It can't." He goes on to say, simply put, how could two people who are sacrificing for each other, reveling in their mutual love, supporting, communicating, honoring, nurturing, and nourishing each other, ever want out of such a great relationship? How could you ever want to leave that? So with the last few minutes here, and I know we're running out of time, what I want to look at here is how can I make my marriage last? Just some tips, some practical things to consider on how can my marriage stand the test of time. The first is this: divorce yourself before you ever think of divorcing your spouse. In fact, when I do premarital counseling with young couples, I always say, you don't even talk about the D word when it comes to your relationship. You don't even mention it. The D word is off the table. Because if you go into a marriage assuming that divorce is not an option, it never will be an option. But when you go into a marriage assuming that you're always going to have an escape route, an escape clause, well, don't be surprised if at some point you feel the urge to use it. Never even talk about the D word in your marriage. Divorce yourself first, because you'll never really have a happy and lasting marriage until you get a divorce from yourself, from your me time, from your selfish pursuits, from the hobbies that alienate you from your family. Until you divorce yourself and your needs first, you will never have a truly lasting marriage. Treat each other like company. 1 Peter 3, verse 7, which we've already referenced, says, "And grant her honor." I like that. One person told me before I got married, always treat Rebecca like she's a special guest in your house. Of course, that doesn't mean make her feel like she's not at home and everything. What I mean is, grant her honor. Roll out the red carpet for your spouse. Treat your spouse like he or she is a special person to you. Rather than the typical mentality, which is, well, now you're stuck with me. Typically, we'll put on a show for them while we're engaged or when we're dating. We'll put on the show, we'll wear the cologne, we'll shave every day, we'll put on clean underwear every day. Yeah, I get it, yeah. We'll put on the show, and then once we're married, we're like, you sealed it, baby. You sealed it in 24 carats. You are stuck with me now. No, never act like that. Grant her honor. Treat each other like Christians. Grant her honor, Peter says, as a fellow heir of the grace of life. Would you ever talk to another Christian the way you sometimes talk to your spouse? Would you ever insult each other, get under each other's skin, annoy each other on purpose? Would you ever betray another Christian the way we would our spouses sometimes? Treat your spouse like he or she is a Christian first and foremost. Because when we leave this beautiful world of ours, marriage will not be there. We will not be married in the afterlife. We will only be resurrected saints, souls. No distinctions aside from that. Treat each other like Christians. Stop listening to what our culture has to say about marriage. Distance yourself from the impressions and misconceptions that culture foists upon us when it comes to marriage. When you think of marriage in pop culture, who do you think of first and foremost? You think of Homer and Marge Simpson, don't you? That's almost right. That's the go-to marriage that we think of in pop culture. What a completely dysfunctional marriage that is. You think of sitcom marriages. And what's in a sitcom? It's almost always kind of a heavy-set husband who's married to a really beautiful woman who's dynamic and extremely intelligent, basically runs the household because her husband is too lazy to get off his duff and do anything. The husband always is forced into doing things. It's the Al Bundy. He's forced into loving his spouse, forced into loving his children, forced into getting off the couch, putting the beer down, turning the football game off, and engaging with his family. And that's marriage in pop culture. Marriage is celebrities getting together. And like I said earlier, oh, they'd make such beautiful children. That's marriage to people. Stop listening to culture. Stop listening to culture. They've got it way wrong. You can either listen to the Bible and its advice on marriage, which prescribes lifetime commitment to a person through thick and thin, or you can listen to our culture, which I think is one of the main reasons why we have a 50% divorce rate in this country. The last point that we'll make. Differences do not drive people apart. I absolutely, unequivocally despise the term irreconcilable differences when it is used as an excuse for divorce. I despise it. I have seen vastly different people who remain happily married for a lifetime. I have seen opposites attract to such an extensive and extreme degree that you wonder how is it possible that those two people ever found each other, fell in love, got married, and somehow or another make that relationship work. No, irreconcilable differences? I don't buy that one tiny bit. Oftentimes, it's our irreconcilable differences that make our marriages exciting. They make them interesting. That's when the sparks fly. Because you don't want to marry yourself, do you? I would hate me if I was married to me. I would drive me crazy, though our house would be really clean. That would be nice. It's our irreconcilable differences that make a marriage work, though. Honestly, you would never want to marry yourself. You want to marry somebody who's better than you. You want to marry someone who's different than you. Someone who will give you their honest opinion when you're wrong about something. Someone who will tell it to you straight. When that outfit just doesn't work. When those pants just don't fit. No, not that one. That's off the table. I don't buy it when people say irreconcilable differences drove them apart. Because really, the only irreconcilable differences out there that can truly drive a wedge between people is sin. Selfishness, dishonor, cruelty, abuse, and adultery. Those are the irreconcilable differences. And if those are your excuses for getting divorced, maybe you're the one who needs to change and not your spouse. Those are the real incompatibilities that hurt a marriage. So I'll ask again, is marriage becoming obsolete or are Americans just bad at it? I think we need to be very, very careful how we answer that question. Who are you listening to? God or culture? Who do you think has the better plan, God or culture? Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. This is your opportunity to make things right with God, to put Him on in baptism. As Mark 16, verse 16 says, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." So whatever needs you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.